the library and the humanities building, which would be using the library most, was 300 yards away.
Right.
But I couldn't understand why they did that or who had thought that.
Now the question, of course, I'm not sure, I don't have in my own memory who had actually laid out that first.
I don't know that. I think Stevens had a hand in it.
It could have been in Stevens somehow, but I think it may
it
well
be.
Otto Tegan, yes. And he was the architect of the State University,
yes,
at that point. But his position disappeared when the State University Construction Fund came into play from a budgetary point of view.
Right.
Steve remained as the liaison for architectural development planning because the construction fund needed to work with and always wanted to and tried to work fully with the state university. But the state university's function was to develop the program it wanted,
right,
and to have us be the units that would get it carried through,
mm-hmm,
as the physical facilities needed. The
Division of Public Works was out of the picture then.
Other than relating to the different activities. For example, if the State Highway Department, if it was in its budget to have some kind of a highway linkage to a campus, which could be budgeted and become a part of a State Highway Spur or whatever, it played the same role as the other state departments played, such as...
Do you know what was behind Nickel Road, how that came about?
I don't remember the specifics of Nickel Road. I remember a couple of things, and I probably somehow in the old archives could find some of it. Let me give you that side of it and we'll come back to Nickel Road. Because I remember that when we first were in the picture, I'm not sure if it was an early one, but it wasn't one of the late ones, was the plan to go visit Stony Brook. And we first went to the office of the architects who had been doing that work, which was Boris, Walker, Foley, and Smith.
I see.
They were
already in the picture then.
They were the ones that did those first buildings that you referred to.
Yes.
Right. Now, that was a very outstanding firm in New York City. It had done the, I think it had done the Empire State Building. No. In any case, Boris had been head of the president of the architects, Institute of Architects nationally, and Ralph Walker had later been president, and had been doing a great deal of institutional work for various universities and so on. They had done great deal of work for the New York Telephone Company,
yeah,
and AT&T itself, and so on. Now, they came in to do that under the previous system, where they were doing relatively little of the schematic work. And they also, I remember very clearly, the one stipulation that was part of the Ward Melville gift was, in some way, he was able to stipulate that the building should not go higher than the pine trees on the site, or hemlocks, or whatever they were. He also came a little later, but in any case, and he also had some basis for claiming there's been a commitment to only do the architectural work in the Federalist style. This partly because he felt that he had done the restoration of Stony Brook that way, and are consistent to that or previous colonial and so on.
It should be compatible with the architecture of the of the community, which he thought of as being Federalist.
Right. Now, we debated that a great deal and talked with the people, and then we had some meetings with him, and we said it should be compatible. His feeling was that meant it should be basically a kind of eclectic reproduction of Federalists, you know. And we were trying to talk our way into the acceptance of some of the principles of Federalists. If you accepted there was actually a style of Federalist, which some historians feel there wasn't, actually, and architectural historians. So we put a great deal of thought and effort into handling that situation and being able to do some contemporary buildings which would look, have the feel of being contemporary and would not continue the eclectic type of various stylistic reproductions which have been going on in many of the campuses across the country, as you well know. My own at Yale, deep into Gothic and so forth. We had a very thoughtful, excellent architect, I'll have to get that name for you. He died after a while. He had been with Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. Because it now sounds wrong, I thought of him this way. And he made a real study of the Federalist things. And we had a big slideshow and a long discussion and so on, going back to Jefferson's Virginia and so forth, and all the others. And we're trying to talk Lord knows. We spent a lot of time on that. In the meantime, we had a meeting at the campus with some of the people from Walker's office. And as I began to hear them talk and so forth, I said, well, now, which of you, each one of, I think, of the ones who were meeting with them, this is the first visit they had made. Now, in a couple of the cases of the three or four people who were there, they had come in since the work had begun. But the others had been there while the initial work was being developed, the design, and this was the first visit they'd ever made to the site.
Maurice Walker?
Yeah. I checked back with the office, a little discreetly, but I wanted to know. No one of their principals had been to the site before letting this work be ground out and doing it, playing a limited role with the public works when they produced those buildings. I felt it was this is now personal, off the record, but I felt it was a very inadequate professional response to what they had. But it was true that by and large, the architects of the state, and what I consider the good architects, most of the serious and professional architects, were not interested in doing the state work, and were, because of the system I just have been describing, and when they would do it, they would sometimes do it and assume that they were doing playing a limited role, and it wasn't going to be their responsibility. They had very little hand in it. It could be changed by anybody. So it ended up being the mediocre work it was. It was always ground through public works, and even to some, the administration of the university at that time would grind it through in comparisons of unit costs and unit budgets that they'd achieved on some other kind of, to my mind, relatively mediocre building. And so this came along. And that's what I think I mentioned to you, somebody later on said what people used to call that penitentiary modern.
Yeah.
Especially the
Neo-penal, we called it.
Neo-penal. Especially the dormitories, I thought, were a bad part of that. So we went quite slowly on the selection of the architects for that, but then finally he selected Paul Danas and Dirk Weigel to lead that, and I would have to look up how we related the planning to that and so on for that.
Danas is still living.
Yes.
He's out on the
Long Island, and I think he has a place in town still. I'm not sure that he's maintained
it right.
In New York. And I've seen him off and on, and I stayed in touch with him. He's a good friend. And I'm sure he would be glad to dig up some of that now. I think Dirk Weigel died.
Right.
I think I remember that he had a heart attack. He had always had some overweight. So. Now,
what we're doing here.
We thought that we might break for lunch about 12:30 if you felt like.
Fine.
If you think it is a good time, we could do it.
All right. 12:30 now. Let's start.
To the appointment of the architects, and one thing I should be very strong about, that I feel very strongly about, and that was that the achievements of the State University Construction Fund were very largely the result of the work of Anthony Adinolfi, who was the director of planning. And in the book which I have just given you here, you will see a photograph of him. This is Tony.
I see.
When the three trustees were appointed and we began to discuss staffing, the New York Telephone, AT&T people gave, New York Telephone Company people, it was, with Phelan, assigned some temporary people to it to help us recruit and so forth and so on. I insisted that the director, the man who would become the director of staff, should have some competence in architecture or engineering or something comparable, preferably in academic. But they came up with the person to be the chief administrator was Dave Straub. Who had been in the quartermaster's section of the Army, I think, during the war, and later on. Highly regarded as an administrator, fiscal officer, etc. And of course, when you accept the fact that, you might say, the activity was two-thirds represented by the trustee for getting it done and getting it financed, and one-third of the thing. So I was sort of reluctant to go along with that, but then we agreed that the next appointment would be the director of planning, whatever the title was. And Ed Nolfi was recommended, and I interviewed him one time, but he had a PhD in education. And then I inquired more about that, and it was, from what institution?
From Columbia.
Columbia. And his concentration was on facilities, physical facilities for that. And then he went to Detroit and worked with Sam Brownell.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the superintendent of schools, the commissioner of schools for the city of Detroit, and who was going, already embarked on quite a big building program, and was using some of the excellent younger architects in the Detroit area. And Tony learned a great deal from that experience before coming to us. To my mind, he was one of the really brilliant people and the ones that were making really, really great contributions in this. He developed a lot of the methodology of the construction fund, the way of working with these architects, as I told you, looking at it from a regional point of view, all the different interests that were involved, how the university could play its maximum constructive role, both as a physical implant, so to speak, and as well as in relation to servicing the community and so on.
He came on board in 62.
Yeah.
I see. Well, Stony Brook started on the Stony Brook campus at what point did his input begin for Stony Brook? Do you know?
Well, that was at the point when the new architects were appointed, when the new buildings were being agreed to proceed. But we had everybody stand back for a while. Well, there was a regional and then local planning analysis and a pretty thorough look at what had been done, how it was going, how it should be. We developed one piece of the methodology, for example, called the design vocabulary.
I remember that.
Which you may remember.
I remember that. John Toll and I were talking about that. That's 65.
Well, the architects who came in developed that for the first, for the campus studies that they made. I'm not sure about Stony Brook, but the principal, but they came in and they made these analyses. They brought it into a series of presentation of the organizational diagram in the abstract of the university and in physical terms laid out. And then that was developed into what was called a site-related diagram, still diagrammatically, but in relation to the physical terms of the site. And then, at the same time, they were studying the thing from the micro point of view, in a way, the design units, elements, and this was where we called it the design vocabulary, which they were to think about and before they even got to thinking about a building or any one of the buildings as such. It was more to think about the atmosphere that should be created, that you hope to, what kind of a background there was in terms of the heritage of the area, what was the sort of intent of the mood of the campus, the nature of the campus, what was its focus in terms of academic focus or general aim. You see, one underlying principle I felt that was the extension, we'll say, of the decision to have the university dispersed and located in the various communities was that not only would the host community have some variety as far as environment for the students while they're going through this period of time, but we wanted to carry on to have the campuses themselves have a variety of nature. Some of them would be fairly highly organized, and I mean, Ed Stone's was one of the most organized in that sense. Some were very loose. I remember at Delhi, up in the North Woods, we went along and kind of moved a lot of the campus in amongst the trees on the side of a ravine, going up to the main body of the campus, which was on the crest of this, but it was still somewhat protected from the winds that came right across from the St. Lawrence and from the Great Lakes, and it would sweep right across. So they were sheltered down and was very loosely placed in amongst the edge of that ravine. The nature of Old Westbury campus is so different from the nature of, well, I couldn't mention anyone. And this is what we wanted, with the thought that the students, in choosing or making the application, would have a chance to look around and try to find one of the kind of campuses that seemed to be the kind of atmosphere environmentally that they would enjoy and be able to work for. Nelson said several times in many speeches that he felt that the physical environment of the 4 years that the students were in on a campus were possibly the most important in developing their appreciation for orderly arrangement of things, of good looking and pleasant and commodious environments, and after, of course, the family and the home originally. Even the schools earlier weren't as important as this 4 years when they were framing their own tastes and their own senses of quality as they would like. And he felt that this was a reason for trying to get the best talent we could in architectural terms and to give them the best possible, the architects, the professional, the best possible contractual arrangements so they could fulfill that possibility.
Well, now, some of the architectural firms at Stony Brook, one was Roth. I've forgotten whether there was a second name.
Richard Roth, or Emery Roth.
Emery Roth, yeah. Kelly Grusin, that was one firm. Dimash Bacone and Wargon. Which architect did the Earth and Space Science building with? That was all poured concrete. No brickwork on that at all. So we had, for a while, we had a number of different architects working on some of the buildings. How were they selected? Who selected them?
Well, let me first say, unfortunately, my memory on that is not as clear.
Well,
I didn't
know what you could tell.
Follow along. It's not. It's important. I didn't follow along after the first couple of years. See, I had been asked whether I happened to be at a conference on the environment in relation to attraction of research activity into New York State. President Folsom of RPI was there. We were on the same panel, and then he said that they were meeting a dean of architecture and he'd like to talk to me. I went to see him with three names and little information about these three people I was recommending to him. I thought that's what he wanted. He said, no, I wondered if you'd be able to do it. I told the governor, and I had not been in academic life at all. I hadn't come up that route at all. I told the governor and said that actually I'd like to be able to bring some activities such as we're doing on the regional development and on the construction fund as and studies that we'd want maybe at RPI and we could make do it sort of jointly there. And it would be very good to bring RPI a little closer to the state activities. It split back in Dewey's time. For some reason, the then president and Dewey got into some kind of unhappiness. So he said, sure, why don't we can do both things and then try to pull it together. Then, and so I did, but then suddenly out of the blue came an invitation for me to go to UCLA. and to start the School of Architecture and Planning there. And that was too exciting a
Remember the year?
Prospect. That was 60. I think I got that invitation then. And-